Oh, hey, it's me again, the Painting Podcast. Thanks for coming by. Today we're going to be talking about the grotesque. What exactly is the grotesque? Can the grotesque be beautiful? Or is its purpose solely to disturb and discomfort the viewer? What role does cultural context play in the interpretation of grotesque art? We'll get into these topics and more, so stick around. Imagine for a minute that you're a Michelangelo and you're at the top of the scaffolding working on the Sistine Chapel. You've got some candlelights in hand and the plaster is falling down into your eyes, and you're beginning to get more and more spiteful against the Pope for giving you this terrible commission. At the end of the day, you come down from the scaffolding and you maybe go get a beer somewhere. I don't know what Michelangelo did. Hopefully he went and got a beer and had a little bit of time to unwind. But something he did in his time to unwind was doodle. He'd make these little tiny doodles, and it's unsure if these doodles were meant for public consumption or not. But among them is a series of drawings with very, very distorted facial features. He would depict somebody like they had a lamb for a head, and their nose was pulled down in all sorts of grotesque manners. Da Vinci did the same thing as well, making a series of grotesque caricatures of people. And so the first thing to think about when we think about the grotesque is to imagine somebody who is creating something unbelievably beautiful, like the Sistine Chapel, something that represents society and the church and the cultures of the community in which it's made. Why would the same person who's making this beautiful testament to religion and Christianity spend some of his time also making these grotesque drawings of lamb-headed people? There's a couple different reasons why Michelangelo may have been interested in this sort of investigation. One of them simply is that, you know, as somebody who was transfixed with human anatomy, grotesque drawings where there's elongated forms and, you know, features that don't make sense, or some sort of chimera, which is a blend of animal and human, these types of investigations allowed Michelangelo to engage in an exploration of human form. These grotesque drawings would allow him to explore and exaggerate the human form beyond these ideal proportions of beauty that were typically celebrated in Renaissance art. And this exploration could be seen as a form of artistic experimentation and study. He's pushing the boundaries of convention and anatomy to better understand the movement and structure of the human body. So there could be a technical element at play here. But it's hard to ignore something else, and that's the fact that these drawings are kind of funny. You know, there's a satirical element to these drawings, and caricatures and satirical drawings are not something uncommon to the Renaissance. So, you know, Michelangelo may have spent all of his time working on all these, you know, magnificent works that were commission pieces too, by the way. So I'm sure there's an element at play. We don't think of it often because we like to think of the artist as somebody by themselves who does whatever they want. However, with Michelangelo, you know, he obviously had these battles with the Pope and stuff like this, and he had to fight for his artistic vision. But even so, he's still making a commission for somebody else. And when he's doing these grotesque drawings, they seem to really be for him, right? They're not going to be something put in a museum. They're not something that was likely meant for public consumption. But they gave him a way to unwind and still be playful with the medium. And this is something that was not uncommon for artists to do. And artists would often create works that were not intended for others. These served more as a private space to explore different themes or just, you know, as I said, relieve the pressures of these commissioned works, right? So these things kind of make sense from the point of view of us imagining ourselves as an artist dealing with these ridiculously huge commissions that take up all of our time. We might sit in a pub and draw some lamb-headed people. That makes sense, right? But there's another element at play as well. And that is the fact that grotesque art has a lineage that goes back much farther than Michelangelo. And it's not a coincidence that what we know of as grotesque art was also discovered during the Renaissance. The term grotesque in the Renaissance period also referred to a style of decorative art that featured fantastical creatures and bizarre forms. This was initially inspired by the discoveries in ancient Roman houses. Michelangelo, like many artists of the time, was likely influenced by these motifs, and he incorporated them and similar themes into his drawings as a way to engage with the popular artistic trends of his era. So there's other people that are engaging in the exact same thing that he's engaging in, and it relates directly to the discovery of these ancient Roman houses. The most famous of them would be one called Domus Aurea. And before I get into what exactly the frescoes looked like in these ancient Roman homes that were discovered, we have to clarify our definitions a little bit. So when I speak about grotesque, more likely than not, you're thinking about something that's gross, right? You're thinking about, you know, a raccoon that got hit by a car and exploded on the side of the road. That's gross, right? And it is also kind of grotesque. We could say that it was grotesque in many ways. However, there's a difference between gross and grotesque as it relates to art and art history. And it goes back to these ancient Roman houses which were discovered. When we talk about the word gross, it comes from Middle English, and it generally means gargantuan or huge, you know, unrefined. Something like that would be considered gross. So our exploded raccoon would certainly be unrefined. That would be gross. Accidentally eating a worm in your macaroni and cheese is gross, right? We can all relate to that. However, when we're talking about art history, we're talking about something else. So it's important in the beginning to kind of differentiate maybe what you thought about grotesque and what you thought about that word meaning in the contexts that it's generally used in our everyday conversations. When speaking about the term grotesque, it comes from the word grotto. And many of you might know what a grotto is. It's essentially a cave that is near some water, and there's all sorts of mystical associations with it. And in prehistoric times, perhaps people lived in these caves. But one thing that's kind of interesting about a lot of grottos and how we think about them is that oftentimes there was heavy deposits of limestone and these sorts of things within them as well. And this created all these stalactites and stalagmites and unusual formations in the caves. And when we're looking at the Domus Aurea, this was a series of buildings that was discovered in the 15th century in Italy. And these were the rooms that I was talking about, these ancient Roman houses. And the Domus Aurea was this huge landscaped complex that was built by Emperor Nero. And it was in the heart of ancient Rome after the Great Fire had destroyed a large portion of the city. Nero's like, okay, let's build a new one. And he builds this huge, beautiful, I don't know what you call it, a complex, right? Like a giant mansion complex thingy. And over the years, this is 64 AD, so 1,500 years passes, and all these rooms actually sink into the ground. So when they discover them, all these things are underground. They don't get the idea that, oh, all these rooms sunk. They think that this complex was built underground. And when they got inside this complex, they discovered that the walls had frescoes of foliage and all these strange animals that were chimeras, you know, two different animals mashed up into one. And that grotto, the cave, associates with the idea of being underground. But inside this cave, obviously it's been being made by Nero, so he's got the best of the best. There's the most beautiful marble There's jewels. He is looking at every single detail. He's got artists painting these frescoes within them. And he does most of this work in about 4 years. But then Nero dies. And the project, a lot of this stuff is just taken. People take all these jewels. They use the marble for other stuff. You know, it begins to decay what he has created. And it's sinking into the ground. That's one thing. It is sinking. But they're putting dirt on top of it as well. They're actually building over it. So they're like, we're just going to build on top of this stuff. There's no use. Because it's on top of this hill. I can't remember the name of the hill. But it's on top of this hill. Trust me. And they build over it. They put baths up there. They put all sorts of, you know, stuff on top of it. And by doing so, this actually preserves all the paintings that are inside of it. So it's some of the best documentation of painting from the Roman era. So 1,500 years later, there's some dude who's walking on the hill and he sees a crack and we don't know, did he fall down? Did he crawl down? I'm not sure. But somehow he got down a crack that had formed because they're throwing dirt on top of these buildings, right? So imagine you've got a roof of a building, you've thrown a bunch of dirt on top of it, and one day you're walking along the hillside and whoa, bonk, right? You fall into this hole and then you pull out your torch like you're in an Indiana Jones movie and you illuminate all the walls and you're like, what the hell is this? You've discovered basically this untouched world that's underground. You know, imagine how weird that must have felt. And inside this cave, you know, a lot of ancient Roman painting, a lot of this painting just, you know, it was painted on wood. So it just, it's gone. So there's all these paintings on the wall and they look very, very weird. And everybody has these mythological and mystical associations with caves in terms of hermits and, you know, people that go outside of society and have these caves and these mysterious places and study alchemy or science or these sorts of things, right? Or philosophy. So you're also, you know, bound up in all this sort of cultural knowledge as it pertains to caves and underground cities. I'm sure we still have conspiracies about underground cities to this day. They probably still exist. There's something within our imagination that loves it. We love this idea, right? The city of lost gold, similar idea. But this guy fell through the crack in the dirt and discovered it. And he got back out. I have no idea. I wish I knew this, like, somebody smart, please comment and tell me more about this person because I couldn't find any more information about the actual discovery and what transpired. But he falls down, or she falls down. I don't even know the gender of the person. And they get back out, and they're telling all the artists in the community, like, I found this thing. And so all these artists start going there. They get lowered down on planks into these rooms, and they start looking at all the walls. And all of this stuff is already hot, as we can say. There's already a trend. There's a revival of these ancient Greek and Roman ideas concerning humanism and painting and drawing and what it means to make something, ideal forms, all this sorts of stuff. So this is already trendy. And then you find this huge monument filled with all these old paintings depicting what we call the grotesque. The grotto. We're in a grotto. It's not a grotto. It's a palace. It's the complete opposite of a cave, but that's how words work, right? And when we say something is esque, right, when we put esque at the end of a word, it means like in the style of or something like that, right? So grotesque means like coming from the grotto, basically. And the Italians would call it grottesca. Sorry for my accent. And from grottesca, the French would begin to call it grotesque. That's why it's got that weird Q-U-E at the end in English spelling. We're taking it from French and their wacky spellings for stuff. So that's how we get the word grotesque. And everybody was interested in it. Everybody, including Raphael and Michelangelo. They went into these underground spaces. And later on, we'd actually find a lot of the walls near these frescoes would have some signatures from other famous visitors. So they found this thing. And this is something I would not advise anybody to do now, But of course, back then was a different time. So they found this beautiful giant thing. And what did people do? They signed their names on it. So down there, we can find the signatures of people like Casanova and the Marquis de Sade, who would also visit these places. It's like a tourist attraction for artists and people interested in this sort of stuff. Filippino Lippi would also put his autograph down there. So artists would go down there, and they're taking this in, and it's changing everything, right? There's a lasting influence from seeing this style firsthand. There's nowhere else that they were seeing this because, as I said previously, a lot of the paintings were destroyed, so they find this authentic source, and it changes everything. And the style and themes from these frescoes, it impacts Renaissance art, especially influencing Raphael and Michelangelo. It also sets up a conundrum that we still don't have clear answers to, because you may have also heard a term called arabesque. And arabesque refers to these types of designs that have all these flowing tendrils and are very detailed, and they're associated with the rise of Islam. But of course, Islam would come hundreds and hundreds of years after the creation of the Domus Aurea. So what is the connection between arabesque and grotesque when we're speaking about, you know, what is found in Rome? It would be more correctly defined as grotesque. However, Michelangelo and Raphael and all these people who are rediscovering this at the period would have also been exposed to arabesque art for hundreds and hundreds of years as well. So the discovery itself coincides with two ways of looking at the world. And of course, there is, you know, we're in Rome, so there is a long history at that point of cultural exchange between a lot of the Islamic world and the Roman world as well. And they're living in this environment, so they're taking in both at the same time, and they're creating their own variation of it. You know, another thing that they found in this discovery was that the layout of grotesques often involved these framed elements in the wall. They're panels. And these panels contain figures and landscapes, but they're also set against this background of decorative elements. So Renaissance artists would adopt this technique, and they would use it to compartmentalize scenes and integrate narrative with decoration in a more harmonious way. There was also a different use of color that was found in these. There was a very vibrant use of color in these frescoes. And this inspired artists to experiment more with their own color palettes. You know, a lot of painting at this time, it would have very, very subdued tones that would be very common in the depiction of events, because when we look out at the real world, right, when we look at the real world out in reality, whatever that means, we don't tend to see very bright, obnoxious, saturated color. Everything is kind of toned down. So when you look at a lot of pre-Renaissance paintings, everything is kind of toned down. If it's a red, it's not a bright, screaming red. It's a chill red. It's a little bit more nuanced. You know, the intensity has been taken down. But within these, whatever we call them, frescoes, within these frescoes, there was a more bold and imaginative use of color employed. They weren't afraid to just use red as red itself. And when we look at the Sistine Chapel, when it got restored, that's a fun thing to look at on your phone, before and after the restoration. It only happened like 60 or 70 years ago. But after it was restored, they found that it wasn't so brown. It was like Disney colors. The blues were really popping blue. And this was a change in the use of color. And it likely was related to the discovery of the Domus Aurea. There's also, you know, a different theme in the grotesques that are discovered. And this ventured more into the fantastical and surreal. You know, these things were, when you mash up these elements, these hybrid creatures and mythological scenes, it's very different than these traditional biblical and classical subjects that these artists were typically told to create. in one place where they could really explore the grotesque in all its different variations would be the depiction of hell. As I spoke about in the other episode I would encourage you to listen to called What the Hell, I just get into paintings of hell. And they're grotesque when we look at, you know, Jan van Eyck's Last Judgment. He's got some amazing creatures that he paints down in hell that are truly grotesque. You know, there's these elongated forms, but they're also fantastical and mythical. And again, we're thinking about grotesque, meaning this elongation of forms and this mashup of animal and human and these sorts of things. And we can find this in all sorts of Hieronymus Bosch, of course, is full of grotesque imagery. These mashups of two different creatures that are telling a broader narrative. But there's something else at play as well, and that's the decorative element. I can't discount that as being important in grotesque art, because we see this foliage that is just beautifully flowing and growing with all these little tendrils. You know, there's a certain beauty in this overabundance of nature and how it's depicted as well. And these decorative elements are seamlessly melding with the narrative that is at play. When we look at something like the Sistine Chapel, of course, we could see this in the depiction of all the tapestry and all the fabric that's flowing through all these designs, right? It's linking all these forms together. It's also linking together this greater narrative. And when you look at it, there's beauty. It's not just depicting a story. It's decorative for its own sake. It's beautiful for its own sake, in a way. And that's one thing we love about Michelangelo, because we as humans like to look at that and see the beauty in all these flowing forms. So we can see that when we speak about grotesque, oftentimes we're speaking about decorative beauty, which is the complete opposite of the smashed raccoon, which we talked about previously being gross, right? And oftentimes we mix up those two words. So how did the influence of the grotesque live on beyond the Renaissance? We know that the Renaissance artists found it, they thought it was cool, and they started incorporating it into their own work. So how did it influence those that came after them as well? Well, the first thing to look at would be the Baroque period. And first of all, there's this emotional intensity that is often characterized within Baroque, and people like Caravaggio would use these intense emotional scenes that would sometimes kind of verge on the grotesque just in their portrayal of human suffering as well as this sort of divine ecstasy. But besides this, you know, emotional display and expression, there's also just ornamental excess, right? When we think about the Baroque, we often focus on, or what comes to my mind at least, is this ornamental excess. And in decorative arts, the grotesque becomes more elaborate. It becomes more ornate. And it infuses Baroque architecture and interior designs with painting. So you've got paintings on the wall, and within them, you know, a painting could even be like a fake part of a column or some plants that are growing around the edges of this fake frame that we have in the wall of a panel that's depicting a certain event. We think about that in Baroque all the time. But when we go back to the origins of it, it's found in the Domus Aurea. It's found in this weird discovery. It's the same sort of ornateness. It's why we connect it later with, you know, Arabesque art as well. There's this intense ornateness when you see these mosques, right? Some of the most beautiful, most beautifully designed structures in the world that are absolutely excessive with their decorative patterns and ornateness. There's also this idea later when we'd get into Romanticism of the sublime and the macabre, right? So we're starting to think of what we might think about grotesque now would be associated with what would be called the macabre, also a French word with a wacky spelling. But the Romantic period sees this resurgence in the interest in the grotesque. And this is often linked to the sublime. You'd get artists like Francisco Goya, who would create this grotesque imagery to evoke terror and awe. You know, we can look at the painting Saturn Eating His Own Children by Goa. This is the stuff of nightmares, of madness, of the supernatural. There's a whole series of paintings from Goya called the Black Paintings, which you can look at. And he painted these on his wall, and he used these very somber colors, right? He's using browns and black. They're called the Black Paintings. And during this time, he feels completely alienated from society. He would have been a good person to include in the isolation episode. But he felt very isolated from society, and he's creating these black paintings on the walls of his home. And so you might be thinking, how did we start with grotesque, meaning this decorative, beautiful, highly colored environment? And we can also refer to Goya's paintings as grotesque hundreds of years later. And the simple reality is that over time, the interpretation and application of the term grotesque is going to expand to include a wider range of artistic expressions that evoke this sense of the bizarre, the unnatural, the disturbing. And this is going to be present regardless of the color palette or decorative intent. So grotesque starts being associated with this sense of the bizarre, like I said. So when the Renaissance artists first rediscovered these ancient Roman decorations, they were inspired not only by the fantastical elements, but also by the strange, surreal quality of the motifs. And as they incorporated these elements into their own work, the term grotesque began to be associated with anything that was unusually distorted or bizarre. This extended beyond purely decorative uses. So over the centuries, this concept of the grotesque evolves to encompass works that depict the macabre, the monstrous, the supernatural. This expansion in meaning reflects this growing fascination with the darker aspects of human nature and the world around us. And it's the idea that something can be disturbing, yet also profoundly compelling. And that's something that we still see today. A lot of people look at contemporary art and they're like, why is it so ugly? Why is it so disturbing? Why is it so dark, right? And a lot of that can be related to this fascination with the darker aspects of human nature and how to incorporate that and how to honestly present it to the world. So in modern contexts, grotesque is often used to describe these works that have this sort of visceral emotional response. They combine elements of horror, comedy, and the uncanny. This use reflects a more psychological interpretation of the grotesque. It focuses on its ability to disturb and intrigue. It subverts normality and expectation. So when we're thinking about Michelangelo making these doodles of lamb-headed people with these elongated, grotesque forms, we can also think about, you know, conceptually, what is happening there? You know, is there something being left out of the Sistine Chapel? Of course, we have hell. His hell looks great. Good job. But hell, it still fits in this Christian framework of good and evil. And the world is more complex and weird and surreal than that. So as an artist, when you start exploring these ideas of the uncanny, you're going to lean more into this sort of horrific comedy that we see. Is the lamb-headed person funny or is it terrifying? It can be both at the same time. And that's what we see in a lot of grotesque art. When we look at Saturn Eating His Own Children by Goya, we see it as something terrifying, right? But as a painter, there's something slightly, I don't want to say comedic, but, you know, he's chomping away at his kid. And this is supposed to be the highest form of art that we have. This debate still goes on today. A lot of people still think, I want art. I don't want to go to a museum and see something gross. I don't want to go to a museum and see something grotesque, right? And it feeds into, you know, today, a lot of grotesque art could also be associated with political realities. that need to be explored as well in contemporary art. There's an element of social and political commentary at play, and the grotesque is often used to critique these issues. So we have artists like Cindy Sherman or Jake and Dinos Chapman who employ grotesque imagery to challenge cultural and beauty norms or comment on consumerism or explore the fragility of our own minds, right? So when we're looking at these contemporary people like Cindy Sherman and we see one of her grotesque photographs, which she's created, this can easily be dismissed by many as, oh, they're just trying to be edgy, right? They're just trying to be an edgy artist. But what I would put forward is that what they're engaging in is actually kind of similar to what Michelangelo is engaging in when he's creating these doodles of these lamb-headed people. So next time you go to a museum, think about that when you encounter something which you feel is grotesque. Go an inch underneath the surface to discover what type of issues are really being discussed. Thanks a lot for listening, everybody. And if you're into this sort of thing, please head on over to oko.academy, where you can read more about my tiny art school in Prague, where I teach and mentor individual students, as well as teach figurative painting and drawing, as well as beginning painting. So you can take a trip to Prague and you can study with me in Prague and develop your own artistic skill and help yourself become a better painter, because we all need to become better painters. It goes on forever, doesn't it? But head on over to oko.academy and check that out. Otherwise, you know, be sure to like and subscribe and do all that sort of stuff. Follow me on Spotify or wherever you do. I do these podcasts once a week. And I really appreciate everybody who's listening, and the growth of the podcast that's occurred in the last couple months has been awesome to see. So thank you so much. And as always, happy painting.